Radio Prague News.
The Czech candidate for the post of European Commissioner has been answering questions from MEPs at a hearing to decide whether he should be appointed. A conference on a new NATO strategic concept is being held in Prague. And after being called out to deal with a traffic accident, police in Prague discovered a man tied up in the boot of a car. The Czech Republic's candidate for the post of European Commissioner, Stefan Fula, has been answering questions from MEPs at a hearing to decide whether he should actually get the job. Mr. Fula, a career diplomat who was once a member of the Communist Party, is in line for the position of Commissioner for Enlargement. At the start of his appearance in Brussels on Tuesday, he said there should be no shortcuts to membership of the European Union. Joining the EU is a demanding task that requires careful preparation, Mr. Fula told members of the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. Tuesday is the second of 4 days of hearings of candidates for European Commission posts. A conference on the future of the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance is being held at the Czech Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Prague. The meeting gives the Czech Republic the opportunity to contribute to a discussion on a new NATO strategic concept being prepared by a team led by the Czech-born former US Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. The concept is set to replace one created back in 1999. Among those attending the conference are the Czech Foreign Minister Jan Kohout and his predecessor Alexander Vondra. The Czech Republic is hoping to buy 4 US Hercules military planes this year. The country's Minister of Defence, Martin Bartak, told reporters. Two of the planes would be flown, while the other two would be used as a source of spare parts. Mr. Bartak refused to say how much the aircraft would cost, but said they would come at a good price. The idea of buying Hercules planes was floated in 2008 by previous Czech Defence Minister Vlasta Parkanova. Police in Prague discovered a man tied up in the boot of a car after being called out to deal with a traffic accident. A police spokesperson said kidnapping could not be ruled out. After a Škoda Fabia and a Citroen were involved in a collision on Tuesday morning, the former sped off. When the police apprehended the vehicle, they found the man, reported to be a lawyer for a big company, in the boot. After several days of heavy snowfall in the Czech Republic, it's no longer snowing. Nevertheless, much of the country has been hit by freezing fog, and the effects of the snowfall are still being felt. Fallen trees are still blocking some roads, while two trains were derailed by fallen trees on Tuesday, though there were no injuries. Since Friday, Prague has seen its heaviest snowfalls for 30 years. And quickly, the weather over the next few days, the maximum temperature in the Czech Republic should be freezing point. Forecasters say it'll be cloudy with some sunny spells. My name is Ian Willoughby. You'll find more stories at radio.cz. But for now, that's the end of the news.
Hello, this is Radio Prague and I'm Sarah Borufka. Welcome to the program. Today, it's D-Day for the Czech Commissioner Designate for EU Enlargement, who is being grilled by members of the European Parliament on Tuesday. The government has approved a badly needed anti-corruption package, but does it go far enough in tackling what many perceive as the country's most serious problem? And a Czech pro-Palestinian activist was arrested by Israeli authorities. We'll bring you the details. Then, later in the program, you can hear an interview with Alan Babický, a highly respected professional golf player here in the Czech Republic. All of that and more coming up, so do stay with us. Parliamentary hearings to assess the suitability of candidates for the new European Commission are underway in Brussels, with the spotlight now on Stefan Fiele, the Czech Commissioner Designate for Enlargement and Neighbourhood Policy. Mr. Fila, an experienced career diplomat, is generally seen as highly suitable for the post, but some members of the European Parliament have questioned his communist past. Daniela Lazarova has more.
In view of his portfolio nomination, Stefan Fila could not hope for better credentials. In the course of his career, he served at the Czech mission to the United Nations. He was the country's ambassador to NATO, deputy foreign minister, Czech ambassador to Britain and Lithuania, and most recently minister for European affairs. He is, moreover, regarded as strongly pro-European and as a man who helped negotiate and finalize the ratification of the Lisbon Treaty in the Czech Republic and Ireland. All these qualities would appear to make him eminently suitable for the post of Enlargement Commissioner. However, much like the EU Foreign Minister Catherine Ashton, there are questions that he will have to answer about his past. For one, his studies at the prominent MGIMO Diplomatic Institute in Moscow, known for its tight links with a former KGB, and his membership in the Czechoslovak Communist Party, a prerequisite back then for a career in diplomacy in the Eastern Bloc. Mr. Fila says that while membership in the Communist Party is not something he can be proud of, it was an inevitable part of the reality he lived in. There was no other place to study top-level diplomacy other than Russia, and one could not do so without party membership. Speaking ahead of Tuesday's hearing, British Conservative MEP Charles Tannock said Stefan Fila's professional qualities and attitude had won his support.
I think he's a very well-qualified candidate. He's been ambassador of my country, United Kingdom, ambassador to NATO, Europe minister. He's very different from the experience that he's got compared to Baroness Ashton. The other big thing about Mr. Fula, which I also recognise and appreciate, is that he has publicly repudiated and said he's sorry for his membership of the Communist Party and also the fact that he's been accused of being schooled at the KGB's Moscow School for International Relations. And so his past, he says he got it wrong in many respects, and now he's moving forward. So I have a lot of respect for Mr. Fula. I don't expect he'll have any problems. He's clearly an extremely brilliant diplomat. And in technical terms, how are we going to fault the man? You know, I mean, I'm going to be asking him some questions, of course, technical questions about the neighbourhood policy, about enlargement. I'm the rapporteur for Montenegro, a country which is of interest to me. But I don't expect he'll have too many problems to pass and achieve a good result before the committee.
If he is appointed to the post, Stefan Fila will not be the first or last commissioner with a problematic past. Estonian Commissioner Siim Kallas was a member of the Soviet Communist Party, and the former Polish Commissioner Danuta Hübner was a member of the Communist United Workers' Party in Poland. German MEP for the Greens, Rebecca Harms, says she doesn't perceive Stefan Fila's past as a threat.
I have a lot of colleagues in this parliament who suffer or could suffer from the same problems. And so I'm open, and I, as far as I can judge on it now, this will not go into the direction that he will sell out European interests to Moscow.
If Stefan Fila gets the job, he will have to hit the ground running. He will find himself dealing with the most crucial period of the Cyprus peace talks, as well as the sensitive issue of Turkish membership. Overall, his portfolio will include a total of 23 countries, including 6 former Soviet states who want to develop closer ties with the EU via its Eastern Partnership program.
Thanks, Daniela. The Czech Republic last year slipped down the rankings of more or less corruption-free countries. Politicians' failure to tackle what is almost universally recognized as a major problem was one of the reasons for that fall. The caretaker government has now adopted a bold anti-corruption package, which it hopes will be given a fast track through Parliament. Chris Johnstone reports on what the package contains and its reception.
Prime Minister Jan Fischer was cautious not to present the package as a magic wand to solve what has frequently been described as one of the biggest breaks on the development of the Czech Republic. But the anti-corruption package, which appears to have been inspired in part by broader measures already in place in neighbouring Slovakia, does call for some fairly bold steps. One of the major innovations is the offer of immunity from prosecution for key prosecution witnesses who agree to testify in return for guarantees that the slate will be wiped clean as far as they are concerned. Another is the creation of so-called police anti-corruption agents. The description agent provocateur is not on target because the government proposal bans such agents from initiating a crime, but does allow them to take part in criminal activities to gather information. The proposal would also tighten up on the rules for awarding public contracts. Those in key positions who could influence the outcome would be vetted in advance by the National Security Authority. This is aimed at shedding light on such decision-makers' backgrounds and possible criminal connections. The package has been welcomed as a step in the right direction by David Ondráčka, the head of the Czech branch of the international anti-corruption watchdog Transparency International.
I think it's a signal that government clearly perceives corruption as one of the major structural problems in this country and that real-life tools need to be implemented. However, on the other hand, we would love to see a rather more complex approach that would not focus only on repression and on repressive measures, which is basically this package.
But Mr. Ondráčka points out that a lot more could be done to make the Czech Republic a less welcoming environment for corruption, for example, by shedding more light on public deliberations at all levels.
There must be a tendency to make everything more transparent, especially when it deals with public funds. What I'm talking specifically is public contracting, public subsidies and EU funds, which are very much vulnerable to corruption. We would like to see more open and more accountable legislative process, which deals with issue of lobbying regulation and issue of transparency of legislative decision. And at the same time, we would love to see much more focus on how at municipalities is dealt with local property and local money.
As well as reservations about the package's scope, Transparency International is also sceptical whether the government can really push through its plans through Parliament before elections due in May. Those doubts have been fuelled by a mixed reception for the package from Czech politicians. The leader of the main centre-right party, the Civic Democrats, attacked the package as unsystematic, artificial, and in some aspects debatable. And he signalled out provisions giving the police greater powers to use wiretaps as a step backwards.
Chris Johnstone reporting. Now turning to a story that made headlines in today's papers. At 3 o'clock on Monday morning, Israeli immigration police and soldiers stormed the apartment of a Czech NGO worker in the West Bank city of Ramallah and arrested her. According to the Israeli authorities, she broke the law by overstaying her tourist visa and was thus promptly deported. The Palestinian organization that she was working for, however, maintains that she was arrested unlawfully in the most recent of a string of raids on activists in the Israeli-occupied territories. Christian Falvey reports.
Eva Novakova began working as a media coordinator for the Palestinian-led International Solidarity Movement only 3 weeks ago. According to Israeli officials, however, she was involved in that time in activities that were incompatible with her overextended tourist visa, namely helping to organize demonstrations. When she returned to the Czech Republic on Tuesday afternoon after being deported, the 28-year-old Ms. Novakova spoke to reporters about her ordeal.
About 20 fully armed Israeli soldiers came into my flat at 3 in the morning yesterday. Then they took me to a number of immigration centres. They told me I could either sign a paper saying I wanted to leave as soon as possible or that I could go to court. They did not explain everything to me properly and they wouldn't allow me to speak to a lawyer before signing.
Ms. Novakova has since spoken to a lawyer who says that neither the Israeli army nor immigration officers have any jurisdiction in Palestinian-controlled Ramallah. According to the International Solidarity Movement, the arrest was part of a more extensive crackdown on non-governmental organizations in the West Bank, using immigration policies, among other things, to arrest activists for political purposes. Earlier today, I put that view to the Israeli ambassador to the Czech Republic, Yaakov Levy.
There is no plan in Israel to use immigration policies as a method to tackle any activities of that nature. She overstayed her 90-day tourist visa, and therefore the immigration police arrested her and brought her to the airport, where she was allowed to choose a lawyer of her choice.
There were soldiers on rooftops, and she was arrested at 3 o'clock in the morning. Is that standard procedure?
It's not standard procedure for guests in Israel to overstay their visa and to engage in activity otherwise than the visa would permit, which is tourism normally. I cannot say if there were, how many soldiers were there, where they were placed, but I can say for a fact that several soldiers did accompany the immigration police.
The ISM states its aim as resistance to the Israeli occupation of Palestine using methods of nonviolent direct action. However, Israeli officials and politicians have on a number of occasions accused them of connections with and giving aid to terrorists. The cases that have most brought the ISM to public attention, however, have been numerous incidents over the last 8 years in which the organization's Western protesters have been killed or critically injured in Israeli attacks on Palestinian demonstrations.
Thanks for that, Christian. Now, in the final part of our program, Jan Wellinger talks to Alan Babitsky, the country's best-known golfer.
This week, my guest in one-on-one is the Czech golf pro Alan Babitsky. A skilled businessman, but also a former dancer, choreographer, and downhill skier, Babitsky picked up the sport of golf only at the age of 28. But within 10 years, he had built up a solid reputation. He even won the World Golfers Championship in Thailand in 2004, one of the most prestigious competitions for amateur players. Well, recently I caught up with Alan Babitsky to discuss his career. I first asked how much he knew about golf the first time he ever played.
Absolutely nothing. Zippo, as they say in the States. Today, if you invite somebody to come to golf course or play golf, they know at least a little bit. They know Tiger Woods, maybe. They know 18 holes. I didn't know any of that.
And how was it that you came to be on this golf course?
Well, I worked as a marketing manager for Pepsi, and we agreed to sign the contract with Karlstein, 1994, I think it was. And they were opening the back nine in September, and I was there in October to sign the contract. And obviously, as you know, all golf enthusiasts, they forced me to try it. So that's how I pick up golf.
Now, was it in this first game, or was it in games that followed that you sort of caught the spark, that you realized, hey, this is a sport that I really like?
Well, it's close to the situation when you say good deeds for bad reasons. You know, I didn't know what to enjoy about it. I just didn't feel anything except one little thing, that it worked well. Somehow I found something which immediately worked. You know, like I never missed the golf ball in a normal situation. I did miss it in like, you know, deep rough with open lob wedge 6 years later, but the first lesson I had, I didn't miss a golf ball, and I never shot over 100. There was something that worked.
Sports, of course, were nothing new to you. You did dance and choreography. You were also a semi-pro skier.
Probably the dance was the better part of sort of, you know, being able to hit the first shots decent and copy the movement of the pro and remember the rhythm and a couple of other things maybe as well. Because when somebody tells you, you know, keep your shoulder, I don't know, up or high or anything, your elbow, if you're not a dancer, it's something new to you.
How long did it take for you to advance your game?
Well, the only thing I remember really was that I spent from the first day, which was something like mid-October, I spent almost every night at the indoor facility, which back then was at Strahov. That facility was closed in January, and at the same time, the Erpet golf indoor facility was open in 1995. It was on the way from my office to home, so I spent every night practicing there. In April, I think it was, I played my first tournament in Karlsbad, in Karlovy Vary, and I shot something like 95. That was the first sort of competitive experience.
And all of this intensive practice was taking place while you were holding a regular day job.
Yeah, of course. It was the same thing until 2004, November, when it was, back then it was a 10th sort of anniversary of hitting the first golf ball, and I happened to win a worldwide tournament which is called World Golfers Championships, which is organized by the Swedish ice hockey player Tomba Johansson, and it's like the equivalent of the World Championships, but with your handicaps. So you play in categories, and your result depends on your game, obviously, but also they deduct handicaps. And I happened to win it. So and that was the reason I decided that I want to go entrepreneur and establish the company that I'm co-owning and working for now. But until then, so it was long 10 years of being a manager of a company, working 10 hours a day and then practicing at night.
Tell me a little bit about the culture of golf in the Czech Republic. Obviously, during the communist years, it wasn't something that had any kind of tradition here. But there was a tradition before the 1948 putsch, wasn't there?
There's a beautiful book called Golf in the Czech Republic, from which I know that Czech Republic was the only country in the old communist bloc which had little bit of golf surviving the socialistic era. We had, I think, three courses here, and something like 1,800 players when I started. In 1994, there was less than 2,000 players and something like five courses. And since then, the golf has grown. Czech Republic has become the fastest growing golf country in the world now. It's the official result of some studies. And now we have over 40,000 players, over 80 courses, and something like 126 clubs. It's been a big boom. The culture, obviously, when you have such a big growth, there is some, as we call them in Czech, child illnesses. Sometimes the growth is too fast. Sometimes the people get the certificates too early. Sometimes the promoters, in order to satisfy the client, don't respect the golf traditions. But overall, you know, lots of good players at the same time. Normally you say that in a golf environment, you've got over 90% of all players never breaking 100. And we did a little study in I think, 1998, and most of the people playing in the Czech Republic break 100.
Why is that?
Well, that's a very good question, which probably leads us to why is golf so popular in here. Because people are playful and they like sports and they like to do it in nature. So you know, that combines for golf. And at the same time, it's a very good platform for marketing. So all entrepreneurs and all big companies utilize golf as a communications or CRM platform. And that's probably it.
You've been a dancer, you've been a business manager. Golf seems to have been the major decision in your life. Can you foresee any other surprises? Is there anything else that you may still try in the future that may once again change everything and change the paradigm?
When I made those changes, they didn't feel like changes because it gradually went from one thing to another, and it sort of grew logically, time-wise and place-wise and everything. There's no more surprises. Life's too short, and I'm 42 now. I'm going to be 43 soon. there's no time to change anything anymore. This is it.
Even when, say, you're 65.
Well, that's a good thing about it. Golf sort of satisfied my childhood dream of being a good sportsman. I really wanted to win the Olympics, and I wanted to win the World Cup skiing, and I wanted to win the Wimbledon in tennis, and just like every other kid, I suppose. But obviously, I didn't make it there. So I gave it up when I was 24 or 5. And then all of a sudden, out of a blue sky, when I was 28, I came to a sport where the age doesn't play such an important role, and you still can play well. You know, it gave me a little bit of satisfaction because I was able to finish sixth at the European Championships, which is not great, but for somebody who starts at 28, it's pretty good. You wouldn't be able to do that in any other sport.
It sounds pretty good to me, I have to say. Alan Babitsky, thank you very much.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Alan Babitsky ending a report by Jan Wellinger. This interview was first aired on October 5th, 2009, and it brings us to the end of today's program. Please tell us if you've got any thoughts on what you've heard on the show today. The postal address is Vinohradská 12, 12099, Prague 2. The address for emails is english@radio.cz. We'll talk to you again tomorrow, but until then, from me, Sarah Borufka, and all of us here in Radio Prague, thanks for listening, and goodbye.